The prosecution of Saddam Hussein for war crimes was dubbed the mother of all trials, and it led to his highly controversial execution. Vanderbilt University law professor Michael Newton was instrumental in advising and training Iraqi jurors for the trial. He joins us now to discuss the book that he wrote with Michael P. Scharf called Enemy of the State, The Trial and Execution of Saddam Hussein. It's published by St. Martin's. I'm very pleased to welcome Michael Newton to the show today.
Hi. Thank you. It's great to be here.
What sets the trial of Saddam Hussein apart from the war crimes prosecutions of other world leaders?
Well, one, of course, is the proximity to conflict, the fact that this was in the midst of an ongoing insurgency. Sometimes there was this visceral connection between the insurgency outside the courtroom and the battle inside the courtroom. That's one thing. The other thing is the very conscious effort to rebuild a society. In many other settings, that's been a separate effort. It's been a separate diplomatic and political effort. Here, this process was integral to the larger effort to rebuild Iraq.
Is that why this wasn't handled the way Milosevic's trial was handled, by shipping him to The Hague?
Well, in fact, for all the pundits and the outsiders that said, well, he should be shipped to The Hague, the fact is that the mechanics of the way this was set up was the only feasible way to do it. And the Iraqis, one thing that they were united about and adamant about was that there had to be a system of doing justice. And so at the end of the day, this is the only real feasible mechanism for doing it, with all of its flaws.
Were you working in Iraq before Saddam Hussein was captured?
By sheer coincidence, yes, I had been advising. By sheer coincidence, I was in Iraq at the time he was captured. We had rolled out and announced the development of the statute just days prior, so that I was actually in the press conference when Ambassador Bremer stood up and said, you know, we got him, that famous press conference, as were some of the Iraqis who were later involved in this process.
Now, Iraqis were not united in their feelings about the capture of Saddam Hussein. Some were really upset about it. What was your sense on the ground?
Well, the sense was, I think you're right, that not all of them were excited about the capture. But I think it's fair to say that all sectors of the Iraqi population were delighted not to have the kinds of things that were committed in their ordinarily daily lives going on. I mean, remember that there are mass graves in Iraq where women can't remarry because they can't physically prove that their husbands are in those graves. The kinds of things that happened under the regime every Iraqi was glad to be rid of, but what they hoped for was a better future. And so that's what the Iraqis were trying to establish.
Can you set the timeline of the trial for us? What preparations needed to be made before the start of the trial?
Right. Well, a huge amount of preparation. And in that sense, this trial is similar to the Milosevic trial and the Charles Taylor trial and other trials, a massive amount of background choreography. The biggest piece of that is the fact that the dictator who survives and thrives by committing these kinds of international crimes cannot allow and did not allow his judiciary to become experts in that body of law. So that's the first foundation, is to really get these judges, and they would apologize. They would say, we're experts in this field, but we don't know this whole range of developments from outside Iraq.
How had judges been selected under Saddam Hussein?
Well, that's one of the great myths that many people had, and one of the preconceptions that I had that's actually false. People think, well, the Iraqi judicial system is a shambles, and quite the contrary. They, if you were ever audacious enough to say, we're here to build the rule of law, they would gently and politely correct you and say, we had the rule of law. Saddam displaced the rule of law. Remember Hammurabi, the first written legal code in the world, came from that part of the world. They say, we gave that to the world. Saddam displaced it. Now what we want to do is to rebuild that process.
So the Code of Hammurabi is something that actually had been built into the Iraqi sense of justice until the Ba'athists took over?
Absolutely. It's on their money. It's very central to the Iraqi judicial context, the sense that we are judges, we are professionals, we are servants of the law, we are not servants of the regime. In fact, many of the Iraqi judges spent time in jail because they defied Ba'athist dictates by applying the law.
Now, would their trials have been similar to the way the Europeans do it, with the judge also being the prosecutor, or did they have jury trials of the sort that we have in this country and in the English system?
Right. Now, that's a very good question. It's a very different process from what most Americans would like to see. It's based on the civil law model, code-based. So by code-based, it means that the judge has has very clear prescriptions. For every issue you can possibly think of, an Iraqi will quote you the provision of their criminal code in the subparagraph and almost the clause. It's very particularized, and they're experts in it. They can off the top of their heads give you. At the end of the day, though, we would have these hour-long debates, and they would say, in our system, here's what would happen, and they would outline the legal reasoning. And I never experienced a time when they didn't come out almost in the identical place that we would have come out, using a very different thought process and a very different set of vocabulary.
So then why couldn't they just try Saddam Hussein based on all of those rules?
Oh, that's a good question. And in fact, there were some minority of Iraqi judges that made that exact argument, right? We have crime, the laws against murder, for example. The problem with that was twofold. One is that there's an evidentiary problem in the sense that the crimes in Iraq were so massive and such a broad scale over so many years. That's the model, the prosecutorial model, that the international crimes are designed to deal with. So it's a much better fit substantively. And then the other problem is, I think, the descriptive problem. Experts call this the expressive value. For the Iraqi Kurds, who had over 2,000 villages destroyed, bulldozed under the ground, it's not enough to just call it murder. That's genocide. The crimes against humanity. It's not enough to just say, this is what happened in this narrow crime. It was a crime against humanity, and that symbolism is very important to them.
So you had to choose the things that he'd be charged with.
Well, the Iraqis did, and this is one of the things that's different about this trial from the Milosevic trial and the Charles Taylor trial and other major international trials, was that it was adapting the international substantive norms into the domestic code of Iraq. So that decision was made in accordance with Iraqi procedural law.
Now, there were a number of different kinds of courts in Iraq, weren't there? There was also the Iraqi Revolutionary Court.
Yep.
Did that function differently than the regular courts?
Well, that's one of the most important aspects of this trial that received almost no public attention outside Iraq, which we document extensively in the book. Because the Iraqi judicial structure was so strong, even Saddam, was never able to completely break the backbone of a professionalized judicial system. So what he did was he simply bypassed it and created a parallel court structure called the Revolutionary Courts. There's a picture in the book. Literally, the man who sat at Saddam's right hand, his right-hand man, throughout the entire DeJail trial, was the chief judge of the Revolutionary Courts. This is the first time since Nuremberg that a sitting judge has been convicted of the crime against humanity for murder, for using judicial processes as what we call the fig leaf for institutionalized murder. And there was this incredible exchange at one point between the trial judge and Judge Awad Bonder, who was sitting there, the chief judge of the Revolutionary Courts. The judge looks down and says, what kind of judge were you in the face of this horrific evidence of the crimes committed under the guise of the law? And Bonder looked back at him with these defiant, sort of beady eyes and said, I was the best kind of judge. And the judge looked down and said, there's no earthly response for that. So the opinion, one of the most important parts of this extensive opinion, first time since Nuremberg, is this documentation of why it is a crime against humanity.
They ruled on the legitimacy of the Revolutionary Courts.
Yes, they did.
And they said that they were illegitimate.
Yes, and that's very important. For the first time in Arabic, all the great cases that I teach and that the people in my field study and that we apply in other settings, not one word of those cases has been available in Arabic until now.
Does this set a precedent for courts around the world or for courts in the area or just for Iraqi courts?
In the region, it sends a very, very powerful message. The judges would repeatedly say to us that their goal, their aspiration, was that this process would serve as the doorway to the Arab world. In other words, this very complex modern body of law that had never penetrated the Arab consciousness until now. It's very important as a message, and it's available in Arabic for people to read and for people to study.
How did the Iraqi judges respond to Westerners telling them how to conduct a trial?
Well, of course, my title and the other titles are international law advisors, and we had written into the statute that advisors were required. So there were others of us who were there. We would put the premium on the word international law. We would feed them jurisprudence. We would feed them ideas. We would answer their legal questions. They put the premium on the word advisor sometimes, and just like any other judge, they would do what they would do based on their preferences and their decision-making of what was important and what was not.
But I suspect there were a lot of people in Iraq who thought these courts are simply doing what the Americans are telling them to do.
That's one of the great myths of the process. More times than I can even recount, we would have these long discussions, which are, of course, privileged and attorney-client privileged. We would reach a particular resolution. The judge would then go out, put on his robes, and do something completely different. But the Iraqis had complete control over this. There were no Westerners in the courtroom.
So the other idea that the decision to hold the trial in Iraq rather than hand Saddam over to the UN was had nothing to do with the Bush administration's distrust of the UN?
Well, remember, the Iraqis, well, a couple things about the UN. Number one, the Iraqis despise the United Nations as an institution because they blame the United Nations for the suffering of Iraqis in the decades after the first Gulf War. But more importantly, the United Nations, as of August of 2003, had completely withdrawn from Iraq. So in the fall of 2003, when they began to structure a process for moving forward, there was no United Nations presence after the tragic bombing, the tragic death of Sergio Vera de Mello, who I believe was the one diplomat in the world capable of squaring the circle and creating a composite hybrid tribunal that really would have incorporated broad international support. With his death, then the Iraqis really had no choice. They either simply didn't try, not just Saddam, but all the leading Ba'athists, or they went down the road that they did go down.
Samantha Powers has written a very moving book about him and his assassination. Do you think he was assassinated because people perceived him as that man who could do all of that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I also think there was a huge symbolic value in driving out the UN and just as a symbolic matter, saying the only people left are the United States and the military members of the coalition. It was a tremendous tragedy because I've served with him in the Balkans. He was a tremendous, tremendous public servant.
My guest is Michael A. Newton, a West Point graduate who serves as professor of the practice of law at Vanderbilt University Law School. During his military career, he served in both the Clinton and the George W. Bush administrations as advisor to the ambassador at large for war crime issues at the U.S. Department of State. He has written with Michael P. Scharf, a professor of law and director of the Frederick K. Cox International Law Center at Case Western Reserve University School of Law, a book called Enemy of the State, The Trial and Execution of Saddam Hussein. It's published by St. Martin's Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Michael A. Newton, who, with Michael P. Scharf, has written Enemy of the State, The Trial and Execution of Saddam Hussein, published by St. Martin's Press. And I mentioned at the beginning that this was called the mother of all trials. I think many people will remember Saddam Hussein's statement that the Gulf War, the first war with Iraq, would be the mother of all wars. It didn't turn out that way, so they understand that. But where does Enemy of the State come from?
Well, not from the movie. Some people incorrectly keep pointing out, well, there's a movie of that title, and so yes, we know that. But there was an incident which in some senses encapsulates everything that happened during the entire trial. During the closing arguments, the retained defense counsel, those who were being paid by the defendants, had chosen to boycott closing arguments. And their argument was, they said, we don't feel safe and secure going to Baghdad, which was just factually false. They had been in Baghdad on Sunday. Closing arguments were Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. Then they were back in Baghdad Saturday and Sunday of the following weekend. So they were sitting in a hotel room in Jordan, and the presiding judge had told them, you must come to court for closing arguments to serve the needs of your clients, to serve the needs of justice. If you don't come, I will appoint standby counsel to make arguments in your stead. So the day of closing arguments came. One thing that the Westerners completely misunderstood and underestimated dramatically was the tremendous physical presence, the tremendous emotional presence. Saddam's aura throughout the trial was large in the courtroom.
Well, he was allowed to talk whenever he wanted to.
Well, he was, because Iraqi procedural law governs that. And we had spent much time with the judges about the processes for controlling that and for keeping the facts focused on the evidence. And yet his presence, his aura, was so large that he could overcome that. In fact, we tell the story in the book. When Saddam was on the run, there's an Iraqi policeman who looked into the back of a taxi cab and saw Saddam hiding under a blanket and involuntarily urinated on himself. That kind of presence. So Saddam stands up as this standby counsel stood up to deliver closing arguments, and he cleared his throat. Saddam points this crooked finger at him about six or eight feet away, and he says, "If you speak, you're the enemy of the state." This is on live nationwide TV, and what he's saying is, all the people out there, find this man, find his family, find his property, punish him for taking an act of courage against me. That man cleared his throat and began a four-hour closing argument. Now, in all fairness, I must point out that they did share the risk. He didn't deliver all 4 hours himself, a number of other attorneys. But that simple act of courage encapsulated much of what was right about this process.
Why wasn't Saddam tried for the extermination of the hundreds of thousands of Kurds in the north or the hundreds of thousands of marsh Arabs in the south?
Well, there are many more complicated cases. And in fact, he was in the original docket. The second trial was the Anfal genocide trial, which was the genocide committed against the Kurds. And Saddam was in the original group of defendants. One thing that's very different from Iraqi law, from our law, is that they are required by law to charge everybody associated with a particular criminal act. They don't charge an individual with all the crimes that individual has committed. They charge based on a subject matter, all the particular individuals associated with a subject matter. So he was named in that second charge for the Anfal genocide, which begs the question, why go first with this much more simple, discrete case that in some senses pales in significance compared to the larger crimes? And the answer is very simple, straight out of Iraqi law. The Iraqi investigative judge had no discretion. Once he had completed his investigation and named the group of people responsible, he is required by law to then turn that case file, the dossier, over to the court for trial. So it was simply ready first.
Now, a dictator often says, well, I didn't order any of those things. It was people who were in lower positions who did it, and I had no idea that they were going to do it. Was there a trail of evidence that went directly to Saddam Hussein?
Well, one of the most important aspects of this book and the trial record itself is that Saddam was ultimately convicted almost exclusively on the basis of the documents from his regime and on his own statements. And there's this wonderful moment during trial when the lawyer is making the exact argument that you just alluded to, which is a legal argument, has some persuasive value. Saddam stands up and interrupts him. You know, the argument is, Saddam was the leader. He's the president. He has no idea what's going on down in the details of this prison or that town or what the local Ba'athist officials are doing. Saddam stands up with this aura of control and power and says, I am Saddam Hussein. Not an Iraqi helicopter flew without my authority. I was in charge at all times under all. And it's like this wonderful moment of, well, you know, I'm sitting in the back.
He's convicting himself.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for that admission. It was a very powerful moment.
Did the U.S. government share intelligence with the prosecution?
We have, as a U.S. government, of course, extensive resources and the ability to share not just intelligence but information, background information, with all the tribunals. We've had a very long relationship with the tribunal in The Hague, for example, and some clear processes in place. So in that sense, this trial was no different than those. One of the most important pieces of evidence in the book and in the trial was a satellite image of this town. They punished the town, and it was an agricultural town, so one of the ways of completely punishing the town and destroying it was to bulldoze to destroy their way of life. So they bulldozed the orchards. So we had a satellite photo that was introduced into evidence of the town before and after, and you see the devastation caused by Saddam's wrath.
Can you tell us why catchers were needed for this trial?
Well, it's the thing we're proud of in this book is that we've written a very readable narrative, the stories, the accounts of the people. And it's a very complex choreography. Everything that happens in trial is just the tip of the iceberg of all the things that have to happen. So every day, all the lawyers, all the defense witness counsel, all the witnesses, all the prosecutors, everybody had to go through this maze of security checkpoints. So in this form of asymmetric warfare, one of the best ways of completely disrupting, shutting down Baghdad is to let loose cats. so that bomb-sniffing dogs simply can't perform their functions, and it creates roadblocks and chaos and tempers and frustration. So in this form of asymmetric warfare, when an enemy adapts, then of course you must react. And so the solution is you bring in cat catchers. And we write, they were from Louisiana, and they were very good at what they did.
My guest is Michael A. Newton, who with Michael P. Scharf has written Enemy of the State, The Trial and Execution of Saddam Hussein, published by St. Martin's Press. The trial was televised. How did the Iraqi High Tribunal fight the perception that it was a puppet court set up by the Americans?
Well, it's important to understand their start point. Their start point was that this will be a tangible, very graphic demonstration of the new Iraq. And remember, because Judge Awad Bandar, the chief of the Revolutionary Courts, was on trial, thousands of Iraqis went to their deaths with no due process, trials in the middle of the night, no due process whatsoever. So they set out to dramatically demonstrate that this was not that. So that's why they made the early decision to televise every minute of the trial all across the region. And in some sense, that was the right decision. I asked an Iraqi engineer from Basra one day, I said, do you think it was a mistake to televise it? He said, absolutely. He said, but I think it'd be a bigger mistake not to televise it or to continue. They naively thought that the simple act of televising would communicate everything that needed to be communicated about the details and about the process and about the false information because people could watch for themselves.
But it also gave Saddam a platform.
Sure it did. Sure it did. And that was a risk that they knowingly took. And, of course, behind the scenes, we had created exactly the same processes as are in place in The Hague and in other tribunals for dealing with a disruptive defendant. But it broke down.
Many people are suspicious, including some of our listeners. One asks, how can you say that Americans weren't involved when the verdict was announced just 2 days before the United States congressional elections in November 2006?
Pure happenstance. To be honest, it was pure happenstance, and I'll tell you why the verdict was announced when it did. It really had nothing to do with U.S. elections. It had everything to do with the fact that this culture that puts the premium on face-saving and on dignity and on process. The judges had announced a date for the decision. So journalists had come from all around the world and dignitaries, and people had traveled across Iraq through a war zone to come and watch the final judgment. And so when that day came, the opinion was not prepared. And so they had a choice. We either embarrass ourselves in front of the entire world, or we carry through with the judgment in the knowledge that we will then issue the written opinion later. The written opinion came out much too late, in my view, but it was 283 pages, unprecedented in that part of the world, to have a detailed explication of the crime base, the facts, but then the legal analysis under crimes against humanity law. That's never happened before in the region.
Another listener asks, was there any serious chance that Saddam Hussein could have been found not guilty by the tribunal?
I don't think Saddam Hussein personally, because the evidence was simply so overwhelming. I mean, when you really look at what happened in the evidence, it was overwhelming. And as I said earlier, he was largely convicted on the basis of his own documents and his own. Now, remember that one of the other defendants was acquitted, and many of the defendants received far more lenient punishments from the judges than many in the Iraqi population would have wanted.
Many people around the world think that executing somebody, no matter what the crime, is unacceptable. Human Rights Watch is an organization that believes that. I think the UN takes that position, doesn't it? I know the European Union does. Was that a consideration? Could Saddam Hussein been found guilty and then just kept in a prison for the rest of his life?
Well, of course. A life sentence, any other form of imprisonment was a viable option. And we deal extensively with the issue of the death penalty. In fact, that's one of the most controversial elements of this entire trial, not just in the way that it was carried out.
Because Europeans, I'm sure, were saying, hey, don't do this.
Well, they were in the design phase of the trial. The Europeans expressly said, we cannot participate in a process. And so what it led to was the United Nations Secretary General telling UN judges who had said, we want to help the Iraqis complete a process that fulfills international standards, that does meet all the standards of due process, that does completely comply with human rights. They were specifically ordered by the United Nations Secretary General not to assist. Some of them courageously did so in their personal capacities. But it was a hugely, and now from the Iraqis' perspective, remember, the whole point is to demonstrate capacity building in the region. and legitimacy and credibility in the eyes of the Iraqi population. So they saw it as a form of legal colonialism. They said, we've had the death penalty in Iraq since Iraq was a country for centuries, going back to Hammurabi, and we want to do it our way in accordance with our law.
Hammurabi said an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. But the execution did become quite controversial, and the Iraqis seemed to lose control of it.
This book really is the definitive history, not just of what happened for all the world to see, but also of what happened behind the scenes. In the chapter about the execution, we give many of the detailed background facts that really help people more fully understand what happened. For example, in this cacophony of voices, which Saddam started, by the way, one voice that was never ever reported in the Western media and never translated is the voice of the deputy prosecutor pleading for dignity and respect.
And shouldn't he have had a more dignified end?
Absolutely, no question. And there were Iraqi politicians who said, do it behind the scenes, do it by firing a squad, do it quickly and professionally, because that is our responsibility to the Iraqi people. I think ultimately, and I was not privy to these conversations firsthand, but the reason, while Saddam was hanged in accordance with Iraqi law, because that's what Iraqi law says, I think he might have been shot, which would have been much cleaner and much more efficient and much more professionally done. The problem with that was that at some point during the trial, Saddam stood up and demanded to be shot. So they didn't want to look and have it appear as though they were simply caving to his will, and they wanted to be able to truthfully say, we've done it in accordance with Iraqi law. The problem with that is Iraqi law specifically says that you cannot be executed on a religious holiday, and they did it anyway, on a religious holiday.
One of the other problems was that the guards began shouting, Muqtada, Muqtada.
Yeah, but the downstairs...
Which made it look like a Shiite Sunni kind of thing.
I write that in 2 minutes and 36 seconds, that videotape and the images of illegitimacy and sectarian revenge will... in some sense, color. It achieved what the defense tried to achieve the entire trial, which was the perception of chaos and illegitimacy. And one of the contributions of this book is to document what truly happened. This was not simply an act of sectarian revenge. We write about Nuremberg. At Nuremberg, Hermann Göring ran circles around the American prosecutor, who is revered, Robert Jackson. But we don't judge Nuremberg solely by that cross-examination. Same thing with this process. It did create incredible perceptions in the Arab world and in other parts of the world, but you have to understand the full range of the history.
But what do you think the effect has been on Iraq and on the insurgency that's followed?
One of the things that was most notable about this process was there was a big debate after Saddam was executed of, do we still follow Iraqi law? Iraqi law says that the body is returned to the family and returned. There was a burial plot pre-prepared. The Iraqis followed their own law, so he was buried. And there was this cry, the assumption outside Iraq, that it would create this martyrdom, that it would inflame the insurgency. And at the end of the day, it didn't do that. The fact is that the Iraqis knew Iraq best. They knew that once Saddam was gone, it would allow them to have the gateway for the military surge that came later, but also the broader effort to restore and resuscitate the broader base rule of law. And that's what they were trying to do.
Michael A. Newton is a professor of the practice of law at Vanderbilt University Law School. He, with Michael P. Scharf, professor of law and director of the Frederick K. Cox International Law Center at Case Western Reserve University School of Law, have written a book called Enemy of the State, The Trial and Execution of Saddam Hussein. It's published by St. Martin's Press. And I want to thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here.
On tomorrow's show, Malcolm Gladwell on why some people succeed while others never reach their full potential. Also, the ongoing debate over who owns the past and why there's so much high-stakes conflict over antiquities, from the Elgin Marbles in London to Egyptian mummies and museums all over the world. Then, a new theater piece about the Department of Homeland Security. Plus, word maven Patricia T. O'Connor takes your calls on our crazy English language. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Stephen Valentino. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Angela Sheldon, Alex Simons, Miranda Schaefer, and Mark Wolf. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening.